Thank you very much, Viru Bodhi. It's lovely to be here this evening. I am feeling very happy. In fact, how can you not be happy coming to Sweden at this time of year with wonderful weather, having been on retreat? And when I lived in Sweden, I remembered that I think it was this time of the year, I always used to think that you Swedes, or those of you who live here, you're at your healthiest. You know, summer's over, you've recovered from the winter, and you're all really enthusiastic, so this is a great time to talk to you. You're not tired yet. Anyway, I'm going to be very serious this evening. I'm going to give a serious Dharma talk, and maybe on Saturday I can allow myself to be silly. I like being silly sometimes. Yes, everyone cares. Well, we do, don't we? It's an interesting thing about human beings, is that we do care. We care about ourselves, we care about, which is sort of perhaps obvious that we're going to care about ourselves, because after all, we are the most important person in the universe. But it's not so obvious that we should care about other people. I don't know if you ever thought about this. You know, why should you care about others? Sometimes we care about others because there's some sort of self-interest. We want other people to like us, so we know that if we care about them, that they will care about us. So it's sort of, you know, us again that we're interested in. But just sometimes we do things where we care about other people that just seems completely strange, you know, that someone might fall down. And before you know what you're doing, you're helping them to stand up. It's not that you particularly want them to like you. In fact, they may even be the sort of person that you would prefer not to go near. You know, if someone who's drunk or something falls down, you pick them up. You have these sort of tremendous acts of courage where someone falls into the river or into the lake or into the sea, and another person just risks their life, sometimes loses their life in order to save that person. They have no idea who they are. Sometimes it's children one quickly responds to, but it can also be another adult. And we go through life at different times just having a very sense of being kind to people, just caring. And if you thought about it too much, like jump in the river and save someone, you think, well, I can't swim, or I can't swim well enough to pull someone out. You might not do it, but a lot of these things are just completely spontaneous. You just seem to have, well, we seem to have, as human beings, this capacity to just do things, to just care for others when the need arises. It's just something interesting to think about, isn't it? It's like it's there as a quality that we all share as human beings. Sometimes we give ourselves a hard time for not caring enough and not doing enough for other people, but at the same time, every single human being has this quality of being able to care when situations arise about another human being. And as I say, it's not always to do with self-interests. So if you think of that quality, you could actually perhaps see that caring is also an aspect, it comes from kindness, that there's part of us that's kind. And I like to think of this kindness, this caring side, is our Buddha nature. Now, Buddha nature could mean all sorts of things. Unless you're a Buddha, you wouldn't really know what your Buddha nature was, actually. But we can sort of perhaps guess what Buddha nature is by looking at the actions of a Buddha. So I'd like to explore in this talk this evening, really, this quality of caring, of kindness that we share. And I'd like to link this eventually to the Bodhisattva ideal. Has anyone here, by the way, never heard the word Bodhisattva before? Bodhisattva ideal. I don't mind if you haven't, because if you haven't, I'll just make allowance and tell you a bit about it. But okay, so it seems like I don't have to do that. Well, the Buddha cared. The Buddha spent several years after he left home practicing terrible austerities in the forest, starving himself and trying to give up all sorts of sensuous pleasures because he felt that that was the way to gain liberation, liberation from the human state. And he eventually gains the state, what we call enlightenment. And some weeks after this state of gaining enlightenment, he decides to share his experience with other human beings. He didn't have to, perhaps, but maybe it is an aspect of the enlightenment experience that one has to, perhaps, one has to go out and share that experience with others. So he went off and he set in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And this traditionally takes place, and we celebrate this on the full moon of July, I think. And this is the time when the Buddha gave his first teachings, his first sermon. And he did this in the deer park near modern-day Benares. And he set in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And in this first teaching, sermon, whatever you want to call it, he makes the point, he advises against two extremes, the extremes of luxury and the extremes of self-mortification, of causing harm to yourself in order to avoid sensuous pleasures. So on the one hand, there was the life of luxury, and on the other hand, the life of being completely poor, starving yourself, living without right clothes, etc., which he was practicing for many years. So he teaches what came to be called the middle way between luxury and self-mortification. What is mortification in Swedish? I can't... you can tell me later. It's just I had that. I just realised I missed that word from my vocabulary. Sorry. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Yeah. So the Buddha teaches on this occasion the Four Noble Truths. Have you all heard of the Four Noble Truths? Would anyone like to say what they are? No, it's okay, I'll tell you. I remember once we used to test people who wanted to join the order. We used to ask them questions like, do you know the Noble Eightfold Path? And they go, yeah. And say, what is it then? And it's right vision, right emotion. And people would get through it, sometimes get 6 or 7. Some people get 8. And that was usually a difficult one. Sometimes we ask people if they knew the Four Noble Truths. Now, not everyone did. And if they didn't know what the three jewels were, then we decided they shouldn't really be part of the order just yet. Anyway, Four Noble Truths is quite an important part of the Buddha's teaching. Okay, and what is the first truth? The first truth is the truth of suffering. Okay. So Buddhism gets labelled now with this label that what the Buddha taught was suffering. I've heard people, you know, refer to Buddhism as a sort of religion of suffering, is what the Buddha taught. Well, he didn't actually teach that. He taught that in life there is suffering. And he says actually, this is what he says in this sutta, the first noble truth. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of pain. Birth is painful. All the ages, painful. Sickness is painful. Death is painful. Sorrow, lamentation, dejection, despair are painful. Then he also teaches that there is a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is craving for sensuous pleasures, etc. He also teaches that there is freedom from suffering, and the way to freedom of suffering. Freedom from suffering is nirvana, is enlightenment, or nirvana, And the way to nirvana is the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to nirvana. So it may not be surprising that some people, when they come to Buddhism and they discover that Buddhism isn't all about suffering, it's about getting rid of suffering, that they're very attracted, because it's a nice idea, isn't it, to get rid of all pain. Now, unfortunately, the Buddha didn't teach this. Sorry to disappoint some of you. Those of you who were on the retreat of the weekend will be very familiar with this, because Vidyamala gave a talk about this subject. So I'm not going to tell you the sutta that she talked about, but it's true to say that the Buddha, in the context of the Indian society, within the context of rebirth, rebecoming, as we technically call it, said that if you could remove craving by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, there would be no more rebirth as a human being. Now, so long as you're not a human being, there is the possibility to be free of suffering. But so long as you have a human body, it's impossible, really, not to experience pain at some time. And pain, suffering, is painful. So this is the bad news, isn't it? Is that so long as you've got a human body, you're going to get a toothache, a headache, a heartache, all sorts of things are going to go wrong. And eventually you're going to get old. And when you get old, you're going to be confronted with death. And I don't know whether death is painful, but the process leading up to death is obviously very painful for some people, and very painful when we think about it, because it's frightening. So there is going to be suffering in our lives. Now, in the sutta that Vidyamala mentioned in her talk, which I really recommend you get a copy of and listen to if you weren't there, the Buddha points out that there is pain in life, and it's not the pain in life that we can be completely free of. It's the pain that comes in dealing with the pain in life that we can be free from. It's called the Sutta of the Dart, and in the Sutta of the Dart, the Buddha says it's like someone being pierced by an arrow, which is painful. So you get this sort of primary suffering. And then what usually happens is that there's a reaction to this primary suffering, where you go, "Ah, I really don't like this," and your whole body goes tense, your breathing becomes short because it's so painful, and you react to it. And in that reaction comes a second dart, which is as though you pierce yourself with that dart, and you get two darts or two arrows stuck in you. It's how you react to the primary suffering. We call this a secondary suffering. It's the suffering that comes from the primary. You can't really stop primary suffering. There's too many accidents in life, too many things that can go wrong with a very complicated organism, the human body. Too many painful experiences that come through the mind, let alone the body. But it's how we deal with this primary suffering, this secondary suffering, that we can really make quite a good job of freeing ourselves from. And maybe ultimately we can learn not to react to the primary suffering and therefore live a life where there's very, very little secondary suffering. So I'm not going to talk about rebirth and all that sort of thing, because I know some people find that a little bit complicated and difficult. But it's probably just enough to say, so long as we have a human body, and so long as we long for a human body, we want to keep the human body. And here I don't want to suggest that you get rid of it, because that would, I'm sure, cause a lot more suffering for a lot of people, and it might cause a lot of suffering for yourself. Do you remember Shakespeare? There's a slight line in Shakespeare in Hamlet. He says something like, "Oh, what dreams may come in the sleep of death." So, you know, it could be a real bad nightmare if you were dead through self-destruction. But we're going to talk about secondary suffering here this evening, and we can relate Buddhism to the secondary suffering. How do we deal with the suffering that comes from incidents in our life that that are painful? Today, we in our medical... In the areas of our life, in the hospitals, medicine, there's a whole idea of just removing suffering. And I believe it's very, very painful for those who work in the medical profession to realise that there's no end to suffering. You can only help so few people, and sometimes you can't help them very much. And it's very, very painful realising that you can only help a few people, and sometimes they come back again, and it's you're not always able to remove people's pain. Sometimes you are, and that's wonderful. You can actually help someone with an operation, with some sort of therapy, or other means to overcome their primary suffering. But we go quite a long way in our modern societies to remove suffering as much as possible. It's not so obvious on the streets. We don't find people, we find people living on the streets sometimes and begging and so on, but we don't find people who are mad, who are handicapped, people who are terrible diseases living on the streets. We're not confronted like that in that way as we would be if we were in some third world countries, in places in Asia, for instance. So sometimes we can get this idea that if only we could arrange everything right in our society, we could remove suffering altogether and life would be fairly pleasant and fairly good. And it's quite understandable that we have this idea, because that's what our whole society is built on, isn't it? If we just buy enough gadgets, enough electronic instruments, enough, new computers or new cars, or not there's anything wrong with these things, but if you think they're going to make you happy, well, they might distract you for a little while from what's going on, but and you think, that's nice. But you get bored with them after a while. But in other parts of the world, it's very, very obvious that there is suffering. And there's always been suffering. And perhaps today in the West, there's less visible suffering than there's ever been at any time in the human world. And if we're not careful, if we concentrate on the pain, the suffering in the world, we can be overwhelmed by it. We can just find it so difficult that we even feel like we're going mad ourselves, that we just can't deal with it. And so sometimes we have to block off, we have to shut off from that suffering. And that's, for some of us, a reasonable thing to do, to protect ourselves. But if we look at how people react to their physical pain, we then start feeling, well, there is something we can do. We can actually retrain ourselves or train ourselves to work with the primary pain that comes at us in life and learn how to deal with the secondary suffering that so quickly and so easily, so it follows on. We can actually do something about that. But very often, our initial reaction to primary pain is a reaction. It's usually unconscious. We have a painful experience. It could be a physical painful experience, a mental one. And immediately what we do is we push it away. We don't want to go near there. We don't want it. We want to get rid of it as quickly as possible. And this is quite normal, intuitive. If you were to, take a stick and poke a dog or something, it would sort of keep moving away, probably bite you in the end, just because it was getting irritated. So it's a sort of normal human mechanism to, move away from the pain. But sometimes the pain is there for longer than we'd like, and the moving away doesn't really help. In fact, what we do when we move away from pain is we usually distract ourselves from it. It's still there, and we usually find something that's more pleasurable to engage ourselves in than actually staying with the pain. In this particular sutta, the Buddha says what the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person does is that they seek sensuous pleasure as a reaction to painful experiences. That sensuous pleasure could be any form of sensuous pleasure. It could also be something that's more pleasurable than the pain. So, I discovered that, if you're in a painful situation, having an argument with someone, although that's quite painful in itself, is less painful than the experience you're having. And so it's actually slightly more pleasurable for you. And it's a sort of reaction that takes place. Sometimes we just, try and eat a lot of chocolate or, you know, take ourselves away and do something really nice. Now, according to the Buddha, if this is done unconsciously as a reaction, what will come is more pain as a consequence. It's sort of obvious in a way. If you've got a painful experience going on in your life and you don't want to face it, what you do is you try to take hold of something else, but you haven't really let go of it. So on the one hand, you're pushing it away, whilst on the other hand, you're trying to distract yourself with something else. So it causes you an enormous amount of stress. Not going near something is unpleasant. You know it's there, sort of it's in the back of your mind somewhere, and you're trying to avoid it, and you're trying to, you know, as quickly as possible, get yourself involved in something else that's much more pleasant. So you've got these two things going on, and this in itself is really stressful, and that causes more pain. And then we want to just end up being happy. We don't want the pain. We start feeling that if we could just organise our lives, we could be in a certain way. And we start trying to fix things down, trying to make sure that things don't move around too much in our life, because if they do, we might be confronted by painful experiences. So we try to fix things down. And as we start to fix things down, people, trying to be confident, you know, trusting in people, it's a way of sort of fixing things down. You know, we talk to people if we really trust them. I mean, it's quite, you know, sensible to do that. But we start fixing people down, things down, and more, and in the end, we start having a sense of ourselves as a fixed thing. Now, we may experience ourselves as a fixed thing in other ways, but we start looking for certainties within our life, being sure that things are real and we can be certain about them. We can feel confident. We're all looking for security, and the way we look for security usually is to bolt things down, to fix them down firmly. So we end up looking for certainties. And we start, sometimes can become obsessed by such things of who we are. You know, who am I? And who are they? And then arises all sorts of questions like, how did I get here? How did I get to be this way? And then we can do sort of a whole process of looking back in the past conditioning and working out this is how we are. And if you have a certain sort of mind, you can become obsessed with, well, who created us like this? Or who created us? And who created this world that I'm living in? And you end up starting to think, well, there must have been a creator. There must be something. There must be a definite world here, because I'm in it, because I'm a real thing, a fixed thing. Funnily enough, the Buddha was never interested in these sort of things. Buddhism has absolutely no interest whatsoever in what's called ontology, the essence of things, the study of the essence of things. So whether this wall is there, really there or not really there, is no concern of Buddhists. It might be a concern of nuclear physicists, you know, people studying quantum theory, quantum mechanics. They might want to know, well, there is a wall there and it's made up of things. It's made up of electrons and molecules, atoms, electrons and so on. But Buddhism has never been interested in this. The Buddha never states that, it doesn't even state that there is a world that we exist within. What Buddhism is interested in is not what we are, but what we do. It's interested in process of what we do as human beings, not what we are. So if you've come to Buddhism to find the answers of, like, who created us and what are we, you're not going to get very many sensible answers. But if you want to, if you've got questions about, well, what can I do with my life? How can I live my life in a way that's going to be less painful? Then there are a number of answers. So Buddhism is a pragmatic teaching. It's about something very practical. It's how we respond to life's experiences and how we respond to the painful aspects of our life. Many of us see our life as a series of fixed points, don't we? We remember, you know, a few weeks ago we were like this, and a few months ago we were like that, and a few years ago we were like that, and many years ago we were like that. And life sometimes seems just these fixed points. But when you try to remember when something starts and something ends, it's not difficult to fix it. It's just as though you start realizing that the human mind is perhaps what fixes things into certainties. So Buddhism takes a certain amount of trouble to point out to us, or the teachings of the Buddha, that everything is changing. It's pretty obvious things are changing, although these walls have been here for 25 years, as far as I remember. It might have been a slightly different colour when I first saw them, but they're still here. And actually, I didn't see them 25 years ago. It was less than that. 15 years ago, yeah. And but, you know, it's fairly obvious that we change, that we grow older. I mean, some of us grow old. And things in our lives change. But we hold certain views about ourselves that don't always change. Sometimes we try to build up a view of ourselves to get a sense of who we are, a certain certainty about ourselves. And we might even label ourselves as, I'm a good person, but more often than not we label ourselves as, I'm a bad person, or I'm not good at this, or I'm not good at that. And these are all just labels that we've given ourselves. Maybe even other people have given us those labels. Oh, you're hopeless at doing that. And then you think you're hopeless at doing that particular thing. So Buddhism goes to quite a lot of trouble to demonstrate that life, or get us thinking, reflecting on the fact that life is a process. Life is a constant flux of things changing. In fact, the Buddha even tries to explain what human beings are in a way that's not always very satisfactory. He says that we're just bundles of things. We usually call these skandhas. Has anyone heard the word skanda? Do you want to know? Have you all done the Heart Sutra in Swedish, in the puja? Have you all done a puja? Have you all said the Heart Sutra? Well, you've said all the five skandhas there. So the Buddha sort of says, well, we're just bundles of thoughts. What are they? The bundles of seeing things, feelings, recognition, habits, and so forth. And so it's just, you get this sense that this thing that I am is actually, it's quite difficult to relate to as being bundles of things, but that's what Buddhism says it is. He also says that experiences are preceded by mind. This also causes problems because now you think you've got a mind, don't you? And we all talk about our mind or their mind or training the mind. I know it's problematic in Swedish because you don't have a word like mind. And actually, the Buddha never used the word mind. That's how we translate it into English. And it's a very, very vague term in English. It's more like chitta or mental events. Mental events is quite a good way of looking at mind, because what mind is, you could say, is a taking a hold of objects. So you see an object, you like that object, you take hold of it, you know, with your interest, and then you start bringing to bear all sorts of judgments about it, because, you know, you have these views about that particular object, and you have habits about that particular object, and then you bring all sorts of things with it. And this is what mind does. It's a process. So experiences are preceded by mind. It's this taking hold of an object there, and then we start experiencing it. And the mind has to take hold of an object for us to experience it. So experiences, the Buddha says in one of these teachings, are preceded by mind, led by mind, produced by mind. One of the problems is for us in this process of suffering is that we just bring so much to an experience. So, you know, someone sort of slaps us on the back, if you're a man, you know, you get a good slap on the back. You know what I mean? Sort of, if you look round and it's your friend, you think, oh, that was nice. And if you look round and it's someone you really don't know, you think, what are you doing? And you have two completely different experiences from the same sensation. And so what you've done is brought all sorts of things to that situation. The Buddha says to a monk, you've probably heard this quote before, to this monk Bahia, who was wearing bark garments. That's the stuff on trees, made his clothes out of. He says, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized, the recognized, will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself, Bahia. When Bahia, for you, in the seen is merely what is seen, in the cognized is merely what is cognized, then Bahia, you will not be with that. When Bahia, you are not with that, then Bahia, you will not be in that. When Bahia, you are not in that, then Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond nor between the two. Just in this way is the end of suffering. Now, you probably don't have a clue what he's talking about. Because I don't. It's a really bad translation. Must have skipped out on that one the last time I gave this talk. But you imagine if you could just see something like a blade of grass and just allow the blade of grass to be a blade of grass. You're not bringing anything of your own to the blade of grass. Of course, you're bringing the name blade of grass, aren't you? Because as soon as you call it a blade of grass, you've brought something to the experience, because you start thinking, well, that's a nice blade of grass, or it's a long blade of grass, or it's a short blade of grass. So you bring all sorts of things to that experience. But if you could just sit, and sometimes you have this experience when you've been meditating for several days or hours, where you can just sit and things are just what they are. You just let them be what they are. You don't have to think, oh, what a wonderful day. It just is a wonderful day. And if you did think, what a wonderful day, then you would be aware, I'm thinking this is a wonderful day, because you're aware that you're thinking rather than just seeing. And this is, in a sense, what the Buddha is suggesting we do, is not react, not bring things to our experience, not bring experiences to a sort of a sensation. And I said before, a lot of the time we're looking for security. And looking for security also brings suffering, because we can't always find security. And we tend to fix ourselves in many ways. So, let's get back to one of the Buddha's teachings. He said that in this text, in the Dhammapada, that experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. He also said that if one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, like the cart will follow as the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. So put in another way, the cart follows the horse or the ox. You know, the ox comes first. So if you act with an impure mind, suffering will come after it, as though you're pulling suffering around with you. Likewise, if one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So it's what we do that makes all the difference in our lives. It's not what we are, it's what we do. We can create a heaven or a hell or something in between. So Buddhism is primarily a teaching about liberating us from reactive actions, unconscious reactive actions. The actions that help us to come closer to this non-reactive state we call skillful actions. There's no good and bad in Buddhism. There's just what is helpful to remove the reactive actions, and there's what's unhelpful to remove the reactive actions. There's what's helpful to remove suffering, and there's what's helpful, what causes suffering. And we usually call those skillful or unskillful. Sometimes we overlay that with positive or negative, and then we usually overlay that with good and bad. But there is no intrinsic good or bad in the usual sense of the term in Buddhism. There's this word skill, at least with regard to actions, there's this word skillful or unskillful. It's kusala or akusala in Pali. So Buddhism plays a lot of places a lot of importance on actions. But it doesn't only place importance on actions, it also places importance on in the intention that's behind the action. Even if you don't act and you have a certain intention, then this will have certain effects according to the teaching of the Buddha. You don't have to believe this, by the way. You can test it for yourself. Certainly you can see that certain actions have results. It's more difficult to see that if you have an intention and you don't act, what the results might be. But if you think about it, if you constantly have certain intentions, you start making yourself into something, even if you don't actually act it out. If you act it out, it becomes stronger. So obviously, if you act out hurting people, you know, if the intention to hurt someone and you act it out, you'll probably have more intentions to hurt people and you'll hurt more people and you, the whole thing will gather momentum. I only say that by way of illustration. It also works the other way. If you have the intention to help someone, to be kind to someone, which is more interesting, then if you act it out, if you are kind to someone, it has the effect on you of wanting, having more intentions to be kind with people. And if you act those out, you have more intentions. And so the whole thing sort of develops and you become a kinder and kinder person. So you find in Buddhism the way to liberation from the secondary suffering or from human life altogether eventually is predominantly concerned with kindness, with caring. The whole system of Buddhist ethics, in fact, is based upon this principle. One could even go as far as to say what the Buddha taught was kindness. It's what Christians would call love. And this is the way to liberation. So how does one follow this way of kindness? Well, first of all, we need to learn to be kind to ourselves, just as we do in the Metta Bhavana. We reflect, we develop a sense of kindness to ourselves. But we might need to look at the fact that when we are craving for sensuous things, for pleasurable things, we're actually being unkind to ourselves. Now, wanting a nice hot shower isn't necessarily a bad thing. If you're constantly wanting hot showers because it's so unpleasant, you're trying to get away from something, you might want to look at that. But if you're setting up your whole life to just want something that's going to, you think is going to make you happy, you'll probably discover that it's causing you quite a lot of pain. When you've got the things that make you happy, you then have the pain, the fear that comes with fear for losing them. So that's painful too. So being kind to yourself is the first thing we have to learn to do. And this is extremely important in Buddhism, to be kind to yourself, to love yourself, and to have feelings for yourself. And that's why in the Metta Bhavana we start with ourselves. You can't really care about others if you don't start caring about yourself. Sometimes trying to care about others makes you aware of the fact maybe you don't care quite enough about yourself. If we are craving too many things, eventually we have a sensation of as though we're on fire, we're burning. Because when we get things, we want more things. And it's like feeding a fire. You know, when there's a desire for things and we feed it, it can be just like feeding a fire, putting more and more fuel in it. And the fire just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it's sort of all-consuming. And you're just spending all your time trying to feed this. And if anyone gets in the way of you feeding this fire, you hate them for it because it's your way of getting pleasure. And the more you're feeding the fire and the more people are blocking you, the stronger your hatred could be. And you realise you're completely you're just unclear about things, confused. You don't know what you're doing anymore if you keep feeding this fire of craving for pleasures. So it's not surprising in his third sermon or teaching, the Buddha taught the fire sermon. Took this very thing, that if you just keep feeding things, as though we're on fire with craving, and on fire with hatred and so forth. Then there's the precepts. What is the first precept? That's the training principle. You know, after you said, you know, we have the three refuges. To the Buddha, I go for refuge. The Dharma, I go for refuge. The Sangha, I go for refuge. That three times. And we have the precepts, remember? For a Skrithana. So what's the first one? That's right, to abstain from doing harm. And it has a positive counterpart, which is to... Go on, shout it out. Yeah, to be kind to others, to act kindly to oneself and other people. So the first precept is about kindness. The second precept is about kindness. The third precept is about kindness. The fourth precept is about kindness. The fifth precept is about kindness. They're all about kindness. All the precepts, all the training principles that you could undertake are all about not causing harm and creating, being helpful and loving and caring towards oneself and others. This perfumes, permeates the whole of Buddhism. If you're not kind, you can hardly call yourself a Buddhist. If you call yourself a Buddhist, you are kind. Did you hear that? You are kind. So if you're thinking, oh yeah, I'm a Buddhist, you are kind. And one of the things that we all have in common is that we recite the precepts. So we have a sense of it being important. Kindness is important to us. We might just sort of think kindness is a feeling or an emotion. But it's something much, much deeper than this. It's not, you don't have a feeling, I'm going to jump in an icy cold river to save a child. You know, something much stronger moving you to do that. So there's some sort of, well, a friend of mine recently described it as a consciousness that emerges, that metta, that kindness, which is another word for kindness, for loving kindness, is a consciousness, an emotion that comes from the depths that moves us. Moves us to do things. In one sutta, the Buddha says that metta glows, it shines, and it flashes forth. So it's quite a powerful consciousness. So when we say kindness, in English it can sound a bit weak. Loving kindness is a little bit stronger. Metta, sort of theoretically strong, but we don't usually know what we're talking about when we say metta. Love, complicated word in English, because we can love, you know, chocolate cake and we can love people. So, you know, is loving a chocolate cake equal to loving people? So this word love is complicated. So you have to sort of get a sense of this, you know, whatever word you're going to use, you have to be aware of it. It's a powerful thing. It's a consciousness that suddenly erupts at certain times. And it's a wonderful feeling when this feeling of kindness erupts within us, when we act kindly, when we give someone a gift, when we celebrate something or someone, or being kind to ourselves. And we place a lot of importance on developing kindness. When do I have to finish? All right. If I carry on and you want to go home, just, you know, I won't get upset. I realise I should have finished a little while ago. And it won't take me too long to go on. So we can develop kindness. And one of the ways, of course, we do this is through meditation, through the Metta Bhavana. There are other types of meditation like the Metta Bhavana. There's the Karuna Bhavana, the compassion, development of compassion. The Mudita Bhavana, development of sympathetic joy, where we can laugh with someone else when they're happy because we feel an empathy for them. And there's the Upekkha or Upeksha Bhavana, where we feel equal. We feel equal to all when we can just be with whoever and we feel a certain loving kindness when it's appropriate. Maybe we don't have that feeling when we're sitting meditating. And just by the way, when you're doing the Metta Bhavana, don't worry if you don't feel metta, because it's not a feeling. It just may be not, it doesn't have to well up at that moment. Okay? And so, you know, when you're doing the Metta Bhavana, you're thinking of yourself and other beings, you're sort of like laying foundations, you know, and storing up things, as it were. So when it shines and it glows and it flashes forth, there's something quite powerful about it. And that's what perhaps you're doing. It's best to see the Metta Bhavana as that. There are many other practices in Buddhism that help us to develop the sense of kindness, of love for ourselves and other beings. And of course, there's practicing the precepts. We can do acts of loving kindness to others. We can be generous to others. We can tell we don't misuse people, but we actually are clear and honest and so forth with people. And we don't lie to people. And we don't confuse people and ourselves through intoxicants. Not that, you know, sometimes things aren't, we could do certain things, but we're not sort of, we're trying all the time to be kind to ourselves and to other people. And in order to practice the precepts, in order to practice meditation, you have to learn to be present in this moment. In fact, in order to learn how to deal with suffering, you have to be present in this moment. So when we meditate, we're learning all the time to be present in this moment with our experience. And one of the great things about meditating is that whatever happens, it's fine. Absolutely fine. In fact, no one can possibly have a bad meditation. There is no such thing as a bad meditation. There may be sitting on your cushion for an hour and at the end of it realizing you did nothing, but then you have a flash of awareness and you know you've been, at that moment you're meditating. And so, you know, maybe sitting on the cushion just allow the mind to wander around all over the place and that was quite pleasant for you, or you were worrying about something that wasn't so pleasant. But in the end, if you just sit and learn to be present with your experience, if you start with one experience and then have two experiences and three experiences in the present moment, you can gradually build on this and eventually you can have more and more present moment experiences. And as you have more and more present moment experiences, you can practice deeds of loving kindness, generosity and so on much more effectively. When we start meditating, one of the problems is that sometimes it's not all that pleasant, is it? Particularly if you've been sitting on your cushion for an hour and at the end of it you think, oh, I've just been sitting here worrying about whether I'm going to miss the bus or not after, you know, because, or, you know, particularly if you're in the talk, you know, you're listening to me and you're sitting there and you think, I haven't a clue what he's talking about because I've just been worrying about missing the bus to get home. There's that. There's also, if you go on retreats, this is a pretty common experience. If you start spending a lot of time meditating, you notice that things start coming up, don't you? Has anyone had that experience? Anyone not had that experience? And this is quite normal, and it's quite disappointing when people start practicing Buddhism that they suddenly realise they're not as happy as they used to be. And then they start realising, actually, maybe they weren't really happy before. You know, one of the things we did at the weekend, we taught people a meditation, if you like to call it that, called a body scan, where you lie down and you go through different parts of your body. And some people, when we teach this to them, they discover that they've got much more tension in their neck and shoulders than they had before they did the body scan. And the danger is they think the body scan did it to them. But actually what they start discovering, it's always been there. And all they've done is become aware of it. You know, and so many of us are sort of walking around like this, but we don't know it. Until someone says, why have you got your shoulder up there? And you say, oh. And you, God, that aches, and putting it down. Sorry, I'm getting silly now. It must be getting late. So one of the problems when you meditate is you start avoiding unpleasant experiences. And sometimes this could be the cause of why when you say you don't like meditating, or you know, it's not very comfortable meditating. What it can be is that when you sit down to meditate, you've had an experience of things bubbling up. And if you start associating meditation with facing unpleasant experiences, you're probably going to get put off meditating. So what you need to realise is that if you're not aware, if you're not in contact with these unpleasant experiences, you're holding them somehow within your body, within your mind, and you're using energy to hold them there. So actually, although initially it may be a bit unpleasant coming into contact with them, it's a way of releasing them. And as you release them, you get more and more interested in the whole process. So if you find that you're having a bit of reaction to meditation, it's probably because it's working. And, you know, it's really helpful that to remember that. You just think, I really don't want to meditate. You think, God, it's really having an effect on me, isn't it? And that gives you a certain sort of, you know, encouragement to go on. So very often we can avoid things. And in the spiritual life, we can, you know, come into contact. just trying to communicate with another person who we, who has the same sort of values as us, can bring us up against things in ourselves that are difficult. And also, some of the suffering that is caused when we is through trying to act kindly, isn't it? You know, we have a good intention to be, to do something for someone, to give them, like 6 bars of chocolate. I gave someone recently on a border convention. It was his birthday, and I didn't know. I went into the local town to get my present, and all I could find was a health food shop. You know what a health food shop is, isn't it? Health cost. And I went in there and I thought I could get him some peanuts or... Anyway, they had some chocolate there, so I got him a bar of chocolate and I thought, that's a little bit mean. You know, he was 50, so I thought, that's a bit of a mean present. So I got him several bars of chocolate. Now, I don't know, maybe that was an act of unkindness, really. He might have been sitting in his room, stuffing himself with chocolate and feeling a bit sick. So sometimes you have to bring a certain amount of wisdom to your acts of kindness. So Buddhism places a lot of importance on wisdom and clarity about what you're doing. And we perhaps, sometimes trying to be kind to people by giving them all sorts of advice. It's another thing Buddhists are good at. Someone says something, you say, well, I know what you should do. You start take up meditating. It'd be really good for you. Might be the last thing they should be doing. You know, someone was mentally ill. It could be quite... harmful for them to start meditating if someone's suffering from some sort of schizophrenic condition. So it's not easy to actually be kind to people sometimes. When people talk to us, at least one of the things we could do, which would be an act of kindness, is actually to listen to them. It's quite hard, isn't it? You know, when someone's talking to you and they say, my life's just so stressful, it's so full of things to do at the moment, I just can't get through them. And what do you say? Well, why don't you stop doing some of them? And you're just giving them advice, you're sort of saying, stop doing some of them. And it's quite difficult to say, oh, is your life really difficult at the moment? It must be, I can understand it's really difficult for you, I'm feeling really stressful. And then you start listening to them. And if someone tells you what you just told them, although it sounds a bit sort of corny or strange, it's actually very, very reassuring to know that you've been heard. So it's so wonderful feeling to, when someone tells you just what you've said in a way that sort of, it's not sort of so, if you just say, I've got a headache, you say, God, did you say you've got a headache? But not very helpful, especially if it's a question. If someone says, I've got a headache, and you sort of show a bit of empathy for them, not sympathy. You don't say, oh, it must be terrible having a headache. That would be sympathy. But, saying, well, you've got a headache. Yeah, I can see that, where you keep putting your hand on your head and so forth. And to actually show people you've really listened to them in whatever way you can. And actually, you find it quite difficult to show people you've listened to them. But at least what you can do is you can stop telling them what to do. Yeah. And if someone has a go at you, that this is the usual thing that happens, isn't it? Someone says, you're late again. Well, you're talking too much. And you say, you're a fine one to talk. You were late yesterday. And you get into an argument, but the first person wasn't sure whether you've heard them or not. They know they've said something about being late because they started arguing with you. But, probably they just wanted to express the fact that they were worried that you were late or something because they care about you. It's extremely important for human beings to feel that in contact, we're in contact with one another, that we connect with each other. This word connection's a bit weak, and maybe a word like love is a much stronger word. And to feel that we are being taken seriously, we're appreciated, we're loved, is extremely important for us. In fact, without it, we will wither and die, and we will become sort of like monsters. So it's very, very important to feel you are connecting with people. And listening to another person is a way of connecting. And then hopefully they will listen to you and you will feel even more connected with people. So connecting with people is something we all share in common. And it's a way in which we can really be kind to others, is to allow ourselves to connect up with them. So kindness is a very powerful path, is a way of liberating ourselves from a reactive cycle. It's a way of first stopping and being aware that we are suffering, because that's the first thing we do when we practice kindness, is that we are aware we're hurting, we're in pain, and we don't push it away. We, if you like, move towards it with loving kindness and accepting that there is pain in my experience, in my body, in my, you know, maybe you feel pain at the moment sitting there on the floor in the chair, and you just accept that, and you don't sort of jump up and rush out and do all sorts of things or get chocolate out or something. You just accept that there is pain. This is an act of kindness to yourself. You listen to other people, it's another act of kindness. We can only do this by being in the present moment. So being in the present moment is all important if we're going to practice kindness. The Dharma will change us if we practice it, because we are practicing kindness. We are learning to be more and more kind. And this is what the Bodhisattva is. I'm not going to say very much about the Bodhisattva. In some ways, it's sort of fairly obvious. Kindness is what is underlying the actions of a Bodhisattva. It's a being who is only interested in people's welfare and their own welfare and helping to bring more and more kindness and care into existence. For the Bodhisattva, or someone is called a Bodhisattva, when kindness, which we all have, which we all can manifest, manifests, develops, comes about to such a strong degree that we feel as though we're being carried along by it. We have a very, very strong intention of being kinder to others. And sometimes this is, you could say that this is what the bodhicitta is. It's the uprising of the mind, citta is mind, of bodhi, of liberation, of enlightenment. It's this mind that wants to help people liberate themselves from secondary suffering, or all suffering ultimately. When this manifests to such a degree, you may feel you have to give expression to it. And sometimes one can do this publicly if it's such a strong consciousness that comes upon one. The Bodhisattva is said then to take a number of vows, where they primarily the vow to deliver all beings from difficulties, including themselves. The only way you can help all beings, deliver them from difficulties, is to make sure you include yourself and to become a lot clearer about your intentions, which means being much more present in the moment, being much more aware that every time you react to a painful experience, you're going to cause more suffering for people. So you need to be very clear, you need to develop wisdom and insight into this. And then from then on, your whole life as a Bodhisattva is orientated around helping others, helping to deliver others from suffering. And the great news is that we're all Bodhisattvas. We all have that within us, to some degree or another. It's perhaps much better to think of yourself as a Bodhisattva that's just blocking off your Bodhisattva nature. That you're just kind, but you don't allow your kindness to come out. It's not as though you have to develop kindness, it's as though it's there already. And all you're doing is doing all the wrong things to let it manifest. You know, it's just that, when you have this pain, you do all the wrong things to deal with it. And it's much better to think of yourself as a Bodhisattva. Once Tishu had said that we're all Bodhisattvas, it's just that some of us are having a little bit of a downtime in an otherwise brilliant career. And this is a much, much better way of thinking about ourselves, as though I'm some sort of little, you know, insignificant, bad person. You know, thinking, actually, I'm a great Bodhisattva, it's just that I got lost a little bit, and I need to sort of, you know, reorientate myself and allow my natural kindness to shine forth, to shine, to glow, and to flash forth. So kindness liberates beings. It produces openness, transparency, clarity, and eventually it brings us to what we call the state of enlightenment. That the enlightened mind is essentially the kind mind. And sooner or later, we will realize we're all living within a field of kindness, a field of bodhisattvas. I better stop there. Thank you very much.